you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, ladies. Hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I'm Jack Fowler. The host, Victor Davis Hanson, is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. I am in kind of gray and cold Milford, Connecticut. Victor is on the East Coast too today. It's rare that we're in the same time zone when we talk. Victor, maybe you're lucky you're not back out in California where what do they call it now? The Pineapple Express?
I don't know. I'm trying to find out I'm trying to find out, Jack, if I have a house. The last time somebody took a picture of it, I couldn't see it. It's under 20 feet of snow.
Staggering.
So staggering. I'm just trying to remember if scissor trusses are very strong. That's what it has on it.
Yeah.
So anyway, today I had to go to the East Coast to speak, and I'm doing complicated mathematical formulas of the weight of Sierra snow per square foot versus what I remember the roof was gauged at. Anyway,
Hope St. Joseph will be protecting you.
Okay, of the snow.
Well, St. Joseph, patron saint of homes, so you know we'll give him the duty here to take care of your
Casa
property.
De Joseph. Okay,
yeah, Jose. So anyway, all that said, Victor, there's so much to talk about. We're going to start with your home turf. By the way, if I had a title the show, I think I'd call it The People's Republic of Palo Alto, because there's so much happening at Stanford, this Silicon Valley Bank. Then we've got Fauci versus Robert Redfield to talk about. So we'll start off with things Stanford, and we'll get to that right after these important messages.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, two things. I hate to lump them together because they're different, but they are Stanford related. So the first is a kind of a topic we've touched on, more than touched on before, Stanford Review. That's the conservative alternative paper on campus, has a piece out looking at the racial component of the new class. And white students are 20% of the Stanford incoming class down from 40% in 2016. So there is some version of affirmative action. Of course, none of these institutions claim they're engaged in affirmative action, but there clearly is. So it's going on at Stanford. The other Stanford thing is news that happened from late last week. I think it was Thursday or Friday, that Stanford Law Equity Dean by the name of Tyrion Steinbeck, along with Stanford Law students, suppressed a talk from Fifth Circuit federal judge Kyle Duncan, invited there on behalf of the Federalist Society to talk about COVID and guns and some other topics. But in a typical thing we see now on college campuses, shouted down, forbidden to talk. The dean talked and gave a six-minute rant about DEI and how dangerous this judge's policies were, how threatened everyone was. I'm for free speech, except not for this guy. Just the latest in one of these episodes, Victor. Stanford, wasn't there some effort recently? I think we talked about some free speech statement came out of Stanford, but damn, it looks like it's the citadel for suppressing speech. So, Victor, two Stanford stories. Go at me whatever way you prefer.
Okay. So the first one, I've written about that, and the Stanford announced that this incoming class of 2026 will be 22% white, even though the white, quote unquote, white population of the United States, and I say the United States because it brags that it's a national university and not a local university. So it's 22% versus about 67 versus 80%. So it's almost a quarter. They are deliberately, they're either saying that the white applicant pool is mediocre now, or they're deliberately discriminating against it because they, not me, not Jack, not you listening, but they follow something called proportional representation. Remember that if it's not proportionally represented, it being the demographic in question, then there has to be disparate impact. In other words, it doesn't matter if there's bias or cause, the impact is not fair, it's disparate. And therefore, you have to make correction. So according to their own theories, somebody did something wrong. You don't have to prove it, but the 67% didn't get the 67% representation. Who did? Well, that doesn't apply. We understand that now because of the way the left has taken over our institutions and doesn't believe in the principles that it jams down our throat. So what you have to do, Jack, if you have 12% African-American and you have a large percentage of mixed race and you have a large percentage of Latinos, and I say mixed race because a lot of people who are Latino or Black are not, 100%. So the mixed race is very important. And if the Asian community is suing, and they are, because although they make up 10% or so of the national population, based on this university's own criteria, which they have told us are essential until the woke movement, they have been discriminating against Asians by not considering test scores and GPAs the way that they apply them to other groups. So Asians, they're afraid of Asians. Let me put it that way. So if you're going to represent all of these different groups, mixed race, Latinos, Blacks, and you're going to have more Asians in their population. And by the way, if you followed Stanford's old standards, there'd be about 40% Asians. And remember, when we say Asians, we're not talking anymore about people from the what we used to call the so-called racist term Orient. And I've said before, it's not a racist term. It's just a Latin word for the rising of the sun versus the Occidans, the setting of the sun, people who lived where the sun rose. But anyway, it's no longer confined to Japanese or Chinese or even Southeast Asians. It includes the entire subcontinent of India and that huge expatriate community in the United States. But anyway, so that's what they're doing, and it gets a little bit more interesting than that because out of that 22%, you have to get you know, half, I think it's 52% are women of the class on average, if that applied to the white 22. So now you have 11% white males. But most of the athletes, not all of them, but most of the athletes in all of these aggregate sports, soccer, lacrosse, all of them, they tend to be white males. I mean, African Americans dominate maybe in football and in basketball, but in baseball. And
not necessarily Americans, though.
No, either. Not necessarily Americans. So then you're getting into the legacies as well. These are people who have a long relationship with Stanford. Not just the donors. These are people who are professors. These are people who are deans. These are people who used to be the former provost, and they have children that they want extra consideration given. Then you have the donors, and the word on the Palo Alto street is if your child is at Castellet or Sacred Heart or Menlo School or Harker School, and they have the requisite criteria that used to get you in IE's 4.0 and a very good SAT score, you're not going to get in unless you donate somewhere between $10 and $12 million. That's a fact. They won't deny that, but that is pretty clear. So when you put donors and legacies and athletes, and you're down to 22%, and then you get rid of over half, you're down to, say, 10%. There is no room whatsoever for your proverbial white male super kid with no connections or money. What I mean is, if you're listening and you're a young white male somewhere in Southern Illinois or, I don't know, in the badlands of Montana or Wyoming, and you have a perfect SAT and you have a 4.5 with AP, and you're an Eagle Scout, and you're not going to get into Stanford. Now, that's probably a gift because it's way overpriced, and you're not going to learn anything when you get here because the curriculum has been hijacked and watered down. But that's what it is. It's a race, and I think they know it. And we're going to, and that's why they've gotten rid of the SAT, because they're at a scene of the murder, Jack, and they're trying to get rid of the murder weapon. And the murder weapon is the SAT, because when the Supreme Court hands down that you cannot use criteria and then exclude people on the basis of race, you got to get rid of the evidence. So now they're saying you don't have to take the SAT, and we're going to look at GPA, but there's other intangibles, work experience, life experience, diversity, all of these other things that we can subjectively analyze. And we'll see how it goes. But what Stanford is doing, of course, is they are making a big gamble, Jack, and that they're making two big gambles. Gamble one is they're saying to their constituencies in the Bay Area, you may have a startup worth $1 billion. You may have a kid that's a whiz kid. You may have known us, but there's not enough room for all of you, because there isn't. So we're going to have to let you go. You can't do it. Sorry. That's the one gamble they're making. And then if they're letting in a lot of students under these racial rubrics, it's not my standards that they have tossed out. It's not yours. It's not the listeners. It's their own. And so if we're talking 2010, Stanford was telling the world, we reject 60 to 70% of perfect SAT scores because we are the hardest university in the country or the world to get into because we demand academic excellence. Now, even then they didn't, but that's what they applied to so-called white people. So now you're going to throw that out. And that's not the end of it. As I said earlier, that's the beginning of it, because then when you bring students in that haven't met your own criteria of what a first-class research global university should be, then what do, Jack? You either can do two things. You can water down the content, or you can change the grade, or you can do both, actually. And they're doing both. If you look at the syllabus and the reading list and the grading patterns, and if you don't want to do that, if you don't want to do that, that means you're some old fuddy-duddy white guy and you say, you know what, there's standards and I'm not going to change. And if I'm teaching humanities of the Western world, we're going to read Homer and then we're going to read Virgil. And then we're going to
read Boethius, and then we're going to read Dante, and then Shakespeare on our first, and okay, but that was geared for a different student body that had different incoming criteria, and this one doesn't. So when you start applying your quote-unquote standards, you're going to give grades disproportionately to people who might not have got on in before, therefore you're a racist. So what I'm basically saying, Stanford has now pledged to make admissions synonymous with graduation. They'll do whatever they can to make sure that people graduate so there's not a pattern of quote-unquote systemic racism. And this is going to already have enormous effects. It's very expensive to get in. And most of the students that are getting in that wouldn't have got in are getting in on fellowships and scholarships. And so we all are via the federal government to some extent. And the tax exemptions that Stanford enjoys as a quote-unquote nonprofit, which we subsidize. We're subsidizing a racist policy where we're looking at people's color of their skin rather than the excellence of their applications. As far as the other one at the law school, we had a federal judge speak, and the Stanford law students started to hector him, and they had some pretty obscene signs, as you know, Jack.
Right.
And they were really awful, and they were trying to intimidate him. And speaking as someone who's been through this, I was at the University of Oregon once when speaking on immigration, when a lot of the Chicano studies students came in, jammed all the front seats and took posters and waved them with signs about me. And I couldn't see the audience. They screamed and yelled. And I looked over at a dean that I had just walked in with, and he left. He wasn't there. Wow. In my case, I skipped out of the dinner, and I said, I don't want to be anywhere near anybody at the University of Oregon.
Right.
But anyway, this is not news. What is new, the disruption is not new, is that the dean of equity, diversity, equity, inclusion, she hijacked the lecture.
Right.
So she got in, interrupted the judge, and then started saying, you don't understand, what you do enrages these people, i.e. all of this disruption, all of this obscenity on the signs. I mean, well, they were obscene, of these Stanford students. You kind of deserved it.
Right.
And that's what she was trying to do. And she should be fired immediately. But of course, she'll be promoted for it by Stanford. And, you know, this is not, we got to remember, Stanford University produced Mr. and Mrs. Bankman-Fried. And so Mr. Fried, the father of Sam, was a tax lawyer working closely with Elizabeth Warren. And Mrs. Bankman-Fried, I think her name's Fried, his is Bankman, she was a dark money bundler for Silicon Valley, $65 million. Close the Gap, I think it was called, or Mine the Gap. My point is that they're under investigation for owning property worth $16 million that may have been transferred. I'm not making any, I haven't heard the court testimony or what, if there's going to be indictment, but they were listed as guarantors of certain property. And I don't think you make that kind of money at Stanford. Apparently they didn't have the money because there were other people put up. I don't know how you put up $25 million, which should have been the 10% of $250 million bomb for Sam Bankman-Fried. But then, of course, right, he's connected. But my point is, both of those professors, one who teaches tax law, and I guess the other one teaches realist theory, meaning the ends can justify the means necessary to get them, are themselves in some way deeply involved with their son's ill-doing. And his son, right now as we speak, is living with the parents on campus under house arrest. Or I shouldn't say house arrest, on bond. But then, you know, not too long ago, they had this professor, I think her name was Michelle Dauber, and she started posting about, remember the Johnny Depp
trial?
Yeah, the trial. And he had that very effective, I thought she was brilliant, that Camille Vasquez, that Hispanic lawyer.
Yeah, right.
She was
People
really
thought
good.
He was dating her, but whatever. Yeah, yeah. She was
very attractive, very well-spoken.
Right.
And this this Stanford law professor started tweeting, like, oh, she's just a pick me girl. And then she started attacking Johnny Depp on publicly. And she said that she hoped that somebody would murder him. And then she said, I hope his corpse is devoured by rats. This was a Stanford law professor. And if you think that's weird, you remember the other one at the House Judiciary Committee when they were rushing through the second impeachment? They didn't have any special counsel. Donald Trump would be tried as a private citizen, but they wanted to get it out after January 6th. And they called in, of course, if you want a left-wing person to bend the law and with a veneer of prestige, you go to Stanford Law School. And that Pamela Carlin, I'll never forget it, she was talking about Trump's 13-year-old son. And she said, you know, the Constitution says that there's no titles of nobility. So if President, you know, Trump can call his son Baron, but he can't make him a Baron. It was just crazy. And when you talk about the Federalist Society, because the Federalist Society sponsored this,
right?
Last year, or 2021, as right before graduation, they circulated this invitation that was kind of fake, but it was meant to be kind of like Babylon Bee, but it was very realistic. It said the Stanford Federalist Society, you know, wants to invite you to a violent insurrection. It's known as a coup, and it's going to conflict with every aspect of law, and here's where to assemble, sponsored by the Federalist Society. And people believed it. And so that law school has something deeply, deeply, deeply wrong with it, is what I'm getting at. And
right,
this is not the beginning and it's not the end. I have a little connection because my mother graduated there from law school in 1946.
Right.
She had gone to the University of Pacific and graduated. Then she went to Stanford and got a second BA and went to the law school. And then I think she was the second woman to be appellate court judge in California. And the first, you know, female juvenile judge in Fresno County and Superior Court. But my point is, she was on the board of overseers of the law school. And when I was a graduate student there, I used to go over and see her at meetings there. And they were very proud, the overseers. They built a new law school. I think Jerry Ford even came out and dedicated in 75, maybe 76. But it was a normal place. It was a normal left-wing place, is what I'm saying.
Right.
This is not it. And all of these people who have graduated from Stanford Law School, except in the last 4 or 5 years, have to be utterly shocked by this. You should not give them any money at all.
Right.
None. It's not a force for good.
Right.
And these students should be really, you know, to tell the truth, they should be ashamed of themselves. I looked at the tape.
Right.
They were yelling and screaming at this federal judge. And then they were having these placards. Finally, the judge had to tell one woman, you have it upside down, your obscenity. And then the diversity person, who was kind of either contextualizing them or defending them or egging them on, at that point, she says they can leave. And then they were kind of like lemmings. It was all performance art. About half of them got up and left. And these are the people who are going to populate Democratic administrations from now on for the next 50 years. And
they kind of mirror an incident from last year at Yale Law School. Victor,
they do.
Where a woman who, I don't know if she was a judge, but she was the lawyer in a particularly important a federal case, and she was shouted down by, you know, the future judges and Supreme Court members of America, where they are suppressing any speech intolerant of any divergent view.
Yeah, I remember that. Wasn't that very controversial law dean? Is her name Gherkin?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, and she said they were all going to be punished. And it was unacceptable. They always say it's unacceptable, right? This is an institution, you know, it's unacceptable. But they don't. I don't think they did anything to them.
The only thing that can be done externally, and I don't know how you feel about this, it was stated in the Yale case, and some people said these kids, if you are a graduate of Yale Law School, no judge, they should not be hired as clerks. And as
I hope they do it with this. Do you think they'll do it with this to apply?
Well, the same. Yeah, that's been some of the reaction also. If I may, Victor, just quickly, you know, I'm looking at an account of what happened at Stanford that Ed Whalen has written, and it says five law school administrators were present while this happened, and then Steinbach, the dean, got up, and her speech was written. So this was quite premeditated. It wasn't that she witnessed something and her passions took over, and she, you know, got up and hijacked the event. She orchestrated it. So
yeah, I know that, you know, you could say, I mean, the Ninth Court is in San Francisco for the Western States Federal Court, and it's the most liberal there is. But Trump did put a few Republican judges on there. So if the judges said, we don't want to have anybody involved from that law school clerking for us, because there were members of the administration there and they either allowed it or they contextualized it, I said, or they agreed with it. And that was contrary to democracy. They're always talking about democracy, but if you have a federal judge and you shout him down, then you're attacking democracy according to their own logic. But more importantly, you can see where this leads, Jack, because the academic legal community is creating a situation in which if you disagree with them, if you're a judge, then you are hurting people and you're endangering their lives. They just established that by fiat. You know, if a Republican judge said, you know what, if you're for abortion, you're killing babies, and therefore it's okay for my supporters to shout down anybody. But it doesn't go two ways. But my point is, you can see what a short distance it is from this to Chuck Schumer, who at that time, I think, was the minority Senate leader in 2019. We went right before the Supreme Court doors with a mob behind him and said, you know, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, you sowed the wind and you're going to reap the whirlwind and you're not going to know what hits you. That was a direct physical threat. Right. And I remember that when he was pontificating about Tucker the other day, I thought, shame on you. And then more importantly, within a year, there were people protesting out at the Supreme Court justices' homes with the one caveat, if they were conservative. So the left has this monopoly on this violent disruption. And they say, we can go break up, speak lectures at law schools. We can intimidate federal judges when they come to our law school. We can have our senators go out in front of the Supreme Court and scream and yell and threaten two judges by name. We can send our mobs to a restaurant to drive out, you know, Kavanaugh. We can go to their homes. And you know what? If an assassin shows up, egged on, no doubt, by all this, and, you know, that things happen. And as far as there's a felony, and it is a felony to assemble, and I know that because my mom had made some pretty controversial rulings sometimes, and there were people upset about it and called her and things like that. It didn't come out to our farm, but my point is that there is a law, federal law, statute says you cannot go to a judge's house for the purpose of intimidating. And when they asked Merrick Garland about that, remember what he said? He said, well, there were law enforcement. We had there were people there at their home, meaning think about the logic of that.
Right.
Yes, they broke the law in the past when there weren't law enforcement protecting the justice system. And yes, they're breaking the law in the present while there is protection. There were still mobbing there. But therefore, because they're not going to be effective in storming the judge's home, I didn't think it was necessary to charge him with anything. It's basically what he said.
He also kind of made it a duty of the U.S. Marshal Service. Andy McCarthy had written about this. You know, oh, well, the marshals were there. It's like their responsibility No, it's not. It's your responsibility.
It's yours.
To have federal to prosecute.
Think about the logic.
They don't prosecute.
Yeah.
The marshals don't prosecute. But Merrick Garland, too busy prosecuting.
It's like a bank. It's like a bank robber who's gone in and robbed a bank once and got away with it. And then he's gone in another time and he's walking around the bank and he's going to rob it. But now he sees there's a policeman guarding it and we can't arrest him because the bank is no longer endangered because now it has guards. But the person who in the past robbed the bank and wants to rob it in the present, we're not going to indict. That's his logic, right? That if you've committed a crime in the past and you want to commit a crime in the present, and that's why you're there, according to the statute, but you can't pull it off and endanger the justices' lives or get on their lawn now or get in their sidewalk and scream or because there's federal marshal, we didn't indict. It's almost as ridiculous as Merrick Garland telling us that he only goes after pro-life people because I guess they're stupid enough to protest at abortion centers during the daytime. But the right. real deal are the pro-lifers who bomb and attack and graffiti and destroy at night. And apparently Merrick Garland is saying to us that law enforcement go to bed at sundown.
Right.
They just don't want to work at night. And I just thought, you idiot. You're telling me that most crimes of any sort in the United States take place between 9 to 5 right. and law enforcement can't enforce it? Does he ever understand anything about the classical connection between nocturnal
right.
and thievery? I mean, come on.
Gosh,
that's
geez.
When crime does take place. So anyway, it's really sad. You know, Stanford, I have a lot of people in my family went there, and I can tell you it's shameful. And it always suffered from an arrogance, and people who went there never, in California, never let you forget about it.
Right.
But an arrogance and wealth. And as I said before, nothing was more striking to me right after George Floyd to come on campus and see two guys in flip-flops get out of a BMW convertible with BLM stickers on the bumper. But that's what is the contradiction about Stanford. It's a rite of passage for wealthy people. It always was that they indulge in, you know, innocent, stupid little liberal hard left stuff. And then they get into the corporate and legal and media, big money, or their parents take care of them.
Well, Victor,
it's not now. It's not now, Jack. It's a hardcore Marxist training ground.
Yeah. Well, a lot of those wealthy people who love Stanford and brandish the brand probably have a significant amount of their money at Silicon Valley Bank, which seems to be collapsing. And we will get your thoughts on that and some of the reaction to that by Fang Fang's friend, Eric Swalwell, and other topics. And we'll get to that, Victor, right after this important message.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Again, this particular podcast is up on justthenews.com and other platforms. I want to encourage our listeners, especially if you're a new listener, to visit victorhanson.com. That's Victor's official website. And you will discover there are certain articles, and everything Victor writes is put up there, and all his appearances. There are links to these podcasts, of course, and other podcasts, other Victor's on other radio programs. But you will not be able to read certain pieces by Victor because they are exclusive. They're called ultra articles, and you need to subscribe in order to read them. It's $5 to get in the door, discounted to $50 a year. There's an awful lot of original material there. So if you love what Victor writes, you really should be subscribing. So that's victorhanson.com. And subscribe to Ultra. By the way, Victor has a piece, an Ultra piece up now. They're not all about politics and policy, but some of the more wonderful pieces, I think, are about Victor's own life on the farm and growing up. And there's a great piece that you've just put up, Victor, called Neighborly Theft. And it's about Howard, I think an adjacent farm owner to your farm, and a man who borrowed a lot and maybe even stole some things. All seem to have a hankering to pick the pears off your trees. But it's a beautiful piece. It's beautiful. And you can't read it unless you subscribe. So that's victorhanson.com. Victor, the Silicon Valley Bank, which is home to a lot of Palo Alto area venture capital. They don't call it Silicon Valley Bank for nothing. Had its trading suspended because there was a run on the bank, essentially a run on the bank. Greg Becker, excuse me, he is the CEO of the bank. And I'm getting these, you know, this is an article, I'm not going to read it, but it's a link from Daily Mail, which I check out several times a day. He, in 2015, I believe, successfully lobbied Congress to get reduced standards of scrutiny on the bank because it was so, you know, it is so low risk. Don't apply those standards to us that you apply to other banks after the 2008 banking fiasco and collapse. And he succeeded. And this bank, I think, is the 14th biggest in the nation. Soon to be, I don't even know if it's going to be a bank anymore. I'm trying to sell it. So, Victor, we have this run on the bank, and it's a lot of that leftist money is in there. I don't want to be there to
it's
be
not
a run
just
on
money,
bank,
Jack. I think there was only 3 to 5% that had less than 250,000 that were covered. I mean, think of that. That the depositors, 97%. Had over 250,000 in the bank. Right. So that's the subtext of all this, that these are the right people and they have a lot of money in there and they're facing a lot of losses and they put Joe Biden in the White House and they want to know where the protection is beyond the $250,000. And it'll come, but I'm just as initial observation, it's not to do with banks, but I can remember in 1983, I wrote about it in Fields Out Dream, Sun-Made Raisin Cooperative collapsed. I don't know if people know that. It collapsed with $27 million. That was a lot in those days, shortfall. It collapsed because the cooperative was not accurately returning to the raisin members what they thought they earned. In other words, it was being poorly run and the market itself was collapsing. But to keep the members in the cooperative and not have them go out to more competitive and better run small independent packers, they paid them money that they did not earn, the co-op didn't earn. They were borrowing. And then when it collapsed, they had about $27 million collapse. But every single small farmer also had something called capital retain, which means they deducted a sizable percentage of your crop and they put it in a rotating fund. So you put it in for 7 years before you got any of it. And that was to capitalize expansion. And so they just took that, Jack, to write off the $27 million. They not only took that, they said to the independent growers, well, you got too much anyway. And so we're just taking your own money that was in here to pay for what you got. And think of the logic. We ran this thing into the ground and you would have all left if you had known what a terrible job
guy's name was Frank Light, had been doing, but we couldn't tell you that because then you would leave and destroy my co-op, your co-op, my co-op. So what we did was we kept paying you out what you would have got if you'd sold your raisins elsewhere, even though we didn't have the money. So we borrowed it, and now they're calling in the loan, and we don't have any money. So we're taking your money and the capital retained. And my family was $87,000. We never got it. We all sued. We got $9,000, and that they owed us, still owe us $79,000. They'll never pay.
Right.
And my point is, like that happen in America all the time.
Right.
All the time, these collapses, and the people get nothing. And this is right in the heart of Silicon Valley. This was the go-to bank for startups. And that's number one to keep in mind. And number two, I think you're going to see more of this because Joe Biden printed $5 trillion. And the debt is now $33 trillion. And in his new proposals, even though we have $1 trillion more in revenue, because of his tax hikes and because the economy is recovering from the lockdown, even though that, it's going to be wiped out by more and more spending. So the left keeps thinking, according to modern monetary theory, you can keep spending, borrowing. And what's happening is a lot of these banks gave loans out. And we all know, I have a son who was very astute buyer. He went out and bought a beautiful home at 2.9 interest, right? That's a 30-year interest.
Right.
And the bank is only getting 2.9, but the inflation right now is 7%.
Right.
The question is, there's millions of people with those cheap interests. There's also millions of municipal concerns that have 1.8 bonds. I think I own some bonds, $20,000 at 1.5 I took out. Right. So they have a lot of bonds out there that they are committed to holding, I guess, at very low interest rates. And so when people want to go into that deposit and put money in there, they expect, what do you get now, 5%? I think 5 or 6%? No, you get 4% on a 2-year bond or something. I mean, a 2-year deposit. But my point is that to get people to put money in the bank, they have to pay a interest rate that is going to cost them a lot of money because their income is not very much because they're getting the interest income from cheap mortgages that they issue. And depending on the bank, it's going to be very difficult. There's not going to be a lot of banks that different from this one, I think. And this one made an error because they announced apparently that they were going to hold on to all of these low interest bonds that they had issued. And they weren't going to just take a one-time hit and buy them out, right? And then reissue them at a higher interest rate. And some people got scared. And then I guess a bank has, 5 or 6% of the money on hand that they owe, and then they just started swarming it. It was right out of It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. The money's in this house and that house, right?
Yeah. And that's where it is.
Right.
And everybody thinks they're postmodern and they're sophisticated, and we live in 2023 and we just don't do that.
Right.
We don't go act like, you know, those people in Wonderful Life, where there's no Sidney Green, what's his name? Lionel Barrymore Jr.
Right. Mr. Potter. Right.
Mr. Potter and Potterville. That doesn't happen anymore. And we're sophisticated. No, it's human nature is fixed across time and space. And people are subject to the same panic. And Mr. Swalwell looks at his Bay Area district, and this is another thing that I think all of our listeners have to realize. This is more important than if another normal bank in Fresno had gone under. I'll tell you why. That this state economy gets income tax revenue from 1% of the households. 1% pay about 52% of all of California income tax, number one, and they are leaving in droves. Number two, we have imported over 5 to 10 million illegal aliens. And if you look at the Medi-Cal budget alone, It is massive, massive. In my little area, the Madera Community Hospital just declared bankruptcy. And why is that? Because the remunerations come from the state and the federal government too late and in too little and of too little value to cover the enormous health expenses that are required to give, you know, 21st century healthcare to people who walk across the border from Oaxaca State. It's very hard to do. It's a very noble thing to do. It's necessary. It's humanitarian, but somebody's got to pay for it. So what I'm getting is California's economy is very fragile. The high earn upper middle class that pays half the income tax is leaving. The other middle class is leaving. They've got billions of dollars off the books in a black market economy, Jack. I can get in my car, as I said earlier, and go down to an intersection 2 miles away. I can buy clothes. I can buy food. I can buy milkshakes. I can buy rakes. I can buy bikes from any of these places. And I will have one thing in common. I will pay no sales tax.
Right.
I can go to a big swap meet 2 miles on a Sunday morning, and the same thing. I will pay no sales tax. So they have enormous underground economy that they can't tax. And they can't tax because if they do, the San Francisco Chronicle or the LA Times will say, right, state focusing on though on marginalized people, communities of poor asked to burden the tax, you know, shoulder the burden.
Right.
And then in addition to this, we're sending back $60 billion to Mexico in remittances. Half of all illegal aliens live in California. I don't know if that ratio stands up, but in theory, it could be $30 billion are leaving the state and going back to Mexico and Central America per year.
Right.
And that is possible because the state is providing medical services and legal services and food services and shelter entitlements to subsidize a person to send $300 or $400 a month back to Mexico. So what I'm getting at is when you destroy the middle class and the upper middle class and you either drive them out or you have an underground economy and you bring in millions of poor people who don't pay income tax and don't pay sales tax in some cases, then you've got to rely on Silicon Valley, $9 trillion in market capitalization. In other words, it's a big suction from the entire globe. It brings right in that $9 trillion worth of value from Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, China. But if you tamper with that, and we are tampering with it, it's laying off millions of employees. We know that Twitter was just terribly run before Elon Musk. It wasn't, right. It's probably worth $2 billion at most, not what Elon Musk paid for. And right. Facebook, they're laying off thousands of employees, thousands. And if you get a bank there that served as the bank to go for startups and it's right now broke, and you've destroyed the confidence of the depositors in that type of bank, and you're still having people send billions out of the United States from California, and the federal government itself is running trillion to trillion two debts, 1.5 trillion, I think, annual deficit, and we own 33 trillion. I don't see, somebody tell me where the solution comes from.
I don't know.
Who's a sober and judicious politician who says this can't go on, or what can't go on won't go on, quote right Herb Stein. So I don't know what's going to happen, but it's kind of a 1929 warning of what could come. And so they have to, the Fed's going to have to come in and guarantee Swalwell thinks all of the money that's lost. And if it doesn't come in, then people will not have confidence in the banking system of that sort. So they'll take their money out and they'll put it in Citibank, right, Bank of America, something that has a better reputation.
But again, Victor,
remember the Biden economy. One last thing. The Biden economy that Joe Biden just bragged about, he just gave a speech and he said he's done more to address climate change than any president in history. And he did that by lowering your heating and cooling bills in your home, even though your natural gas has gone up 27%, your electricity has gone up 12%. But he lies. But when you have a president like that, and you have an economy like this, where are you going to put your money? Because you're now raising it. I think the March is going to, the March inflation rate, we're going to find out next week. Mm-hmm. It went from 9.1 to in February down to 6.4. I think it's going to go back up to 8.5. I don't think we're near out of this. So we're going to have stagflation where we're going to soon have massive layoffs, a slowing of GDP, lowering this high inflation. And where do you put your money? Well, you have three choices. You can put it in the stock market. The Dow took a big hit because of this, and it's not performing. Anybody look at your 401k, it's not very encouraging. Or you can go into real estate, and those people who know how to do it will make money, no doubt. But it's falling nationwide. And I suppose if you already have money, it's a good time to buy and then sell later. But it was an overheated, inflationary, expansionary market, way right. overpriced. And now the interest rates on 30-year homes are down to, or up to 7.1, and nobody's buying homes. They can't afford it. So the price is crashing. And maybe you can put it in a bank, huh? And get your 4% on a passbook account if you keep it in there for 6 months while you're losing 3% to inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That's 7. It's not very good. And a lot of people know that. And they're doing risky, risky things.
Or, Victor, you could put this back to the point you made earlier and bouncing off of Swalwell, who's been tweeting, you know, all the assets should be covered over, and people commenting on his tweets of, like, well, why the hell should I pay for it? Why the hell should other Americans pay for the people in this bank? You know, you could invest in a small business as opposed to just land or put money in a bank or even
the reason
gold.
That you should pay, Jack, is the same reason. The same reason during the COVID lockdown. If you had a small shoe store or florist shop where right. one person came in every 10 minutes that you knew, you were deemed a health hazard and you right. had to shut down. If you were Walmart or Target and you sold shoes or flowers and there was 500 people massed in your store, that was okay. That was safe.
Right.
And that's how the federal government's bureaucracy worked.
That's
and
just
the ethos.
It's absurd. You know, my asset in a small business is can go poof, but somebody with $2 million in Silicon Valley Bank has to be
two.
Covered.
That would be nothing. Two.
Small potatoes.
Yeah, 10, 15 million. Yeah. And so you're talking about a lot of money, but yeah. Swalwell is very worried for a couple of reasons. These are his donors. These are the right. people who give money to him, and they have called him up and said, listen, Eric, you idiot, I don't give a damn about Fang Fang. All I want you to do is start making some calls and making sure that Biden, whom I gave to, guarantees my $4 million that I lost, or I'm never going to give another penny to you people. And he's getting a lot of those calls.
Yeah. Is he the congressman, by the way, for the for Palo Alto?
No, he's up near the Livermore corridor on 580.
Okay.
And he's the bedroom community on of the more distant BART stations.
Right.
So he's about 45 miles. It's a very affluent. He's from a very, very, very affluent area of, you know, I don't have the map. I don't know exactly.
Right. I don't know that there's not a non-affluent area around there, Victor.
But it's that area in when you go over the Altamont Pass and you go to Livermore, then you go, there's Pleasanton right there, and then you can go up on 680 to Dublin. I think the next one is San Ramon, Danville, okay. Walnut Creek. There's that yeah. famous Blackhawk exclusive area. That's one of the wealthiest areas in the Bay Area. Yeah. A lot of Silicon Valley people live there.
Well, Victor, that's all discouraging. And this, your commentary here and on previous podcasts, like we are on a looking over the brink of some sort of civilizational abyss. And this is the economic aspect of it. Well, we have time for one more topic, and that's our old friend, Anthony Fauci. And we'll get to that, Victor, right after this, right after this final message.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I need to make a little plug for myself, Jack Fowler. I write Civil Thoughts, a free weekly email newsletter published by the Center for Civil Society at AMFIL, where we are. We try diligently to strengthen civil society. It's totally free. We don't sell your name. And what do you get when you subscribe? I try to come up with 12 to 14 interesting articles I've come across that week. Here's a link. Here's an excerpt. I think you'll like it. You're intelligent. It's not transactional. It's Civil Thoughts. Go to civilthoughts.com. Sign up. I think you'll like it. So, Victor, a couple of things happened on the Hill this week, and we don't. Maybe on the next podcast we could, like, Elise Stefanik going, you know, grappling with FBI Director Chris Wray. But we had the congressional hearings with Matt Taibbi about Twitter files. But we also had Robert Redfield, who's the former head of the CDC, who was up on Capitol Hill. And he said, now let me just get this in front of me. He said, I'll just paraphrase. Look, he went up and he said, essentially, I was shut out of meetings. I did not agree with this monopolist position that Fauci and others had formulated at the very, very origin of the COVID pandemic, but early first inning. And we could not say that this came from the Wuhan lab. I disagreed with that. I was deliberately kept out of meetings because I would express the sentiment that maybe it did come out of the Wuhan lab. He said this on at the congressional hearing, and Fauci was on Fox. I got to give him credit for going on Fox, but he was with Neil Cavuto, and he said absolutely a lie. You know, that wasn't true. He did not keep Redfield, but I think it's pretty amongst the many other things that are coming out slow. So bing, one after another, incriminating Anthony Fauci for knowing what the cause was and ruining careers and preventing the rest of America from finding out that this was not only that came from Wuhan, but it came with money funded. The taxpayer money that Anthony Fauci spent in violation of rules prohibiting such. So Victor, we've gone over this terrain before, but this is the most recent.
Yeah, I think his biggest problem is that if a Joe Manchin or a Sinema, somebody wanted to censor him, if they could get a majority in Senate, because he outright lied to, when he, remember when he was questioned by Rand Paul, he said that,
right.
I think it was the NIH, he said it did not, it never had funded gain of function research in Wuhan. That's a lie. And he said that while under oath. And I think a lot of people are going to go after him. But what he's really angry about is that, you know, Dr. Robert Redfield, I mean, my God, he's the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And he gets up there and unlike Fauci, he was not combative. He was philosophical. And this is the guy they've turned on, Jack. Collins, Francis Collins and Fauci, everybody has turned on him because he always said there was a possibility that it came from the lab. And what he did, and I watched the testimony, and matter of fact, it wasn't very emotional. They just kind of said, yep. They said, well, when Anthony Fauci was communicating with Francis Collins, was there a worry, a perceptible worry that information would come out that they had a role in sending via Echo Health money for gain of function research? Yep. Yeah, that's true. Later, when Dr. Fauci quoted a scientific paper that suggested that there was no lab leak, that came in part in totality from an animal. Did he have anything to do with that paper? Yep. Did he help commission the paper? Yep. Did he participate or edit or look at it? Yep. So in other words, Dr. Fauci was quoting as the definitive analysis of the origins of the Wuhan lab leak to prove that it wasn't the Wuhan lab leak, it was a natural transmission, but he didn't tell us that he himself had commissioned that study in the same fashion that we learned that Peter Daszak had helped get a group of scientists to go to Lancet and run a quote-unquote investigation. They went over to China. They were completely stonewalled, which didn't bother him a bit. They came back and said it was not a lab leak. And now we know pretty much, according to the Department of Energy and the FBI, it was a lab leak. So this raises the question, were people like Collins and Fauci and Daszak terrified because they were subsidizing, in the case of Daszak, actually participating in gain of function research that was illegal in the United States. And they deliberately circumvented U.S. law stealthily and funded this type of research in a very insecure French-built Wuhan 4 lab that very quickly came under the control of the People's Liberation Army. And that virus was engineered in part with U.S. expertise and subsidies. And therefore, did the million people who died in the United States, in some way, can that be traced back to the laxity and poor judgment of Anthony Fauci? That's what this is all about. And it looks increasingly as if that it would be true.
Right.
And I think that's why Fauci does not look very well. I mean, he's over 80, he's going to retire, but he's not the confident, cocky person that used to interview him in his study with his little bubble heads, renditions of himself and the posters on the wall and the paintings of him. You remember all that?
Yeah, it's one of the more narcissistic rooms in America.
Yeah, he's trying to find a sympathetic voice, Neil Cavuto, kind of a never-Trumper, kind of a... I've been on his show. He's a very fair guy, but Fauci thinks that this will be a sympathetic. I don't think Cavuto will be sympathetic, but he's on there. He's going to all of the networks, hinting that Redfield is wrong and that's unfair. If you want to read A Plague Upon Our House by Scott Atlas, he pretty much laid it out that Fauci was wrong. And then the other part of the story is, and the other people have picked it up, there's actually two parts, Jack. The first is that not only did he commission a study and participate in the shadows upon its completion, and not only did he, then he referenced that as self-exculpatory to himself in a very unethical fashion. He not only did that, but there's been charges that if you, I don't know how many it is, $50, $60 billion, if you had a research lab in the United States and you wanted to be funded via Anthony Fauci, then you were going to have to adopt the Wuhan pangolin-bat story, or you wouldn't be funded. In other words, he was using the money of the American taxpayer to further his own personal ambition. And that's very deadly. The other thing was even more, Stephen Quay, whom we had on, I had interviewed, and I think I'm going to interview him again this month. He said in a series of interviews that not only was this gain of function, but that it was gain of function about a engineered virus that must have been interrupted before completion and had a lethality rate in retrospect of about 1% of the infected. Mm-hmm. However, there was some indication of the genome sequence and what we had learned before there was a complete news blackout, and what the expertise the Chinese had acquired might seem would give them the possibility to go further, that they were working on viruses that could kill 10% of those infected, which he said at that point, you're looking at Armageddon. If 10% of an infection can kill, and even 30%, and that would be in bioweapon territory. So there's some life and death questions in all of this.
Right.
And all Anthony Fauci has to do is get off the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases with his incestuous relationship with the National Institute of Health and the CDC, the new directors, and Francis Collins, who's retired. And once he's retired, Jack, guess what? He will not be the arbiter of these federal grants. And every independent researcher will speak his mind, especially if they have a feeling that there's going to be a change in administrations in 2 years. And so I think, I don't want to see any, I'm not unhappy that he did so much damage, because a million people died. And in some ways, he was culpable, not just right. from his bad advice and misleading statements about the lockdown and mask, especially about the ironclad immunity of the mRNA vaccinations, but he did, if this is true, and I think it is, that he participated in a type of research that was too dangerous to perform and then was undertaken by our worst enemies in communist China.
Right.
And he's culpable. And when he's no longer, he's kind of like, I guess the image everybody should keep in mind is he's riding a tiger right now. And the tiger is a furious truth. And right. as long as he's on the saddle, he can suppress that truth, because he has financial leverage over the people who have the expertise and capability to tell us what the truth is, but won't.
Right.
Because they feel that that tiger, you know, is controlled by him. But once he gets off, that tiger is going to maul him. And it's going, the truth is, and right. it's going to be a bad, bad situation.
Yeah. Victor, others, by the way, it's not... It's bad to fund the research, but as you've discussed in the past, the research itself as a thing that you would engage in gain of function is so Frankensteinian or Stinian, it's immoral.
Well,
they
ask a lot of the they ask Mr. Redfield, and they've asked Mr. Quay a simple question: do you know of any major breakthrough in virology that has come from gain and function research? And they couldn't cite any. And then Fauci was on all the airwaves. Well, so you got that flu vaccination? That was gain and function. Well, is that scientifically proved? Or are we supposed to believe you once again?
Right.
But it doesn't seem to me that it's very smart to let all of these labs all over the world that don't have the protections that we used to have, and I don't know if we do anymore because we're destroying our own meritocracy, but to allow people to tamper with them. All it takes is some Iranian agent you know, to go into somewhere and kidnap somebody in,
right,
I don't know, Thailand or former Soviet Republic, bring them back to Iran, put a gun to their head and say, we're going to kill your family. I want you to make this virus. And then I want you to make a vaccination for this virus.
Yeah.
And then unleash it. And that's what we're headed to, thanks to people like this. So,
yeah, the science.
So arrogant. I am the science. All the people's lives that he destroyed. I mean, he destroyed a lot of other scientists' lives. He ridiculed them. He made fun of Jay Bhattacharya and the Great Barrington Declaration. They went after them. He was involved in the Twitter suppression of any story he felt was hostile to the narrative. He was wrong on everything. He should have been fired. Donald Trump should have fired him a long time ago. That's my only criticism, really, of Donald Trump, has been appointments. He appointed people, and I understand that he was not a politician, and I understand the bipartisan Washington swamp tried to drown him when he came in. I understand how all about the Mueller investigation, all the terrible things they did to him. But it was not just appointing people like Omarosa and Scaramucci and all those people. It was not firing right away first day James Comey. It was not firing earlier Andrew McCabe. It was not firing Christopher Wray. It was not firing Mark Milley. It was not firing Anthony Fauci and Burks and Collins. He should have fired them all.
Yeah, for a guy whose popular TV show ended with "you're fired," it's kind of odd as president. He did not do that himself. Well, Victor, shared a lot today, as usual, brilliance. I appreciate it immensely. Listeners, almost to a person, thrilled to you, to what you say, according to the reviews we get, again, on Apple and iTunes, you can rate the show 0 to 5 stars, and nearly everyone gives Victor 5 stars. We thank those who do that, and some people leave comments. We read them all, take them to heart, especially the ones that say, shut up, Fowler. But here's one that I'd like to share from Mrs. Cochise, a veteran of the U.S. Army, Cochise on the Warpath, who I think we read a comment from her early on a couple of years ago on this podcast. But it's titled "A Long Maine Winter with Victor Davis Hanson." And this is, well, this looks like it's maybe Mr. Cochise. Victor, my wife and I, now in our late 60s, live in one of the farthest northeast townships in the state of Maine. So no surprise, the winter can be rather harsh, unpredictable, and long. Unfortunately, this winter has been a real doozy. Next to that, wisely chosen, neatly stacked, extra cord of split firewood. You and Jack and Sammy have helped make this winter a little milder. Many nights sitting in front of the wood stove, yellow labs at our feet, and a bowl of my wife's many excellent soups and chowders. Listening to this podcast has made this old couple's evenings quite special, and we thought you all should know that from your number one fans from the great state of Maine. May God forever bless you all, the Cochises.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's very sweet.
And there's a lot more of you than you think.
Yeah.
Remember that. I was on the plane, and a couple people came in up to me and wanted to talk about the podcast, and that's what they said. But they said it in a different way. They said, there's a lot more of us than you think. And we're going to have a reckoning. And I think if we can get the balloting straightened out in 2024, this woke thing is on the decline. It really is. People are sick of it. And
did
all
anyone
the damage
tell you to,
and destruction.
Yeah, did anyone
Excuse
tell
me,
you
Jack.
To be? Go ahead, Victor.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you, did anyone ask you to be nicer to Sammy? I think it has come up before.
I was in the Dallas airport, I must confess, and a woman a little bit older than I am came up and said, I like your podcast, but have you noticed something about poor Sammy? And I said, oh, no, here it comes. She says, she always has to say, can I be allowed to say something? I said, that's a ruse. Come on. And she said, no, you just crush Sammy when she asks questions. Oh. And she's trying to help you. Just don't I said, she's free to ask anything she wants. I don't even know what she's going to want. I don't prepare. She just does it.
Yeah.
So, and she gets to do, she has a blank check. Sammy does. But I don't know how this got started. I'm somehow crushing poor little Sammy.
Sammy's great. You and Sammy do great podcasts. So, hey, Victor, thanks so much. Thanks to all who listened. And we will be back soon with yet another episode of the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.